1-800-735-1035 or go to kpfk.org/donate.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. And if you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power.
Hotep, which in the language of ancient Egypt means we come with justice in peace. Welcome to Freedom Now, a Saturday Pan-Africanist and Internationalist World Affairs program. Freedom Now is committed to the principle of the rights of all peoples and nations to self-determination. We thank you deeply for your contribution to KPFK, which permits programs like Freedom Now to stay on the air. In this era of corporate acquisition and co-optation of all dissident media, we provide the microphone challenging their corporate and racist point of view. So stay tuned for Agenda here at Freedom Now.
Habargani. This is Sister Thage with Freedom Now's Agenda for this Saturday, June 28, 2025. This hour, prolific author, radical historian, professor of African American studies at the University of Houston, and Freedom Now co-producer, Dr. Gerald Horn interviews Cedric De Leon, professor of sociology and labor studies at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and author of the book Freedom Train, Black Politics and the Story of Interracial Labor Solidarity. And later in the hour, Dr. Horn interviews John Jeter, two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist and author of the book Class War in America, How the Elites Divide the Nation by Asking, Are You a Worker or Are You White? Our music clip mix includes MLK, Zap Mama, Mary Lou Williams, Wayne Shorter, Roy Hargrove, Clifford Jordan, and Prison Radio Commentaries. So sit back, phone a friend, and as always, we stand ready for revolution.
For KPFK Los Angeles, this is Gerald Horn, and with me on the line is Cedric De Leon, professor of sociology and labor studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and author of the book Freedom Train, Black Politics and the Story of Interracial Labor Solidarity. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK Radio Los Angeles, Professor De Leon.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for joining us. So why did you produce this book?
I wrote it because of my experience as the first director of color of the UMass Amherst Labor Center, which is the oldest worker side labor studies graduate program in the country. And what I wanted to do as director was to kind of shape the agenda of the wider labor movement around intersectional solidarity, a vision of solidarity that says that the struggle for economic justice is inseparable from the fight for racial justice and gender equity. And while the overwhelming majority of the folks in the labor center and who are in the sort of outskirts of the network of the labor center were super supportive of that vision, I did encounter some principled resistance, and I wanted to kind of dig into that and discover what the sources of that might be within the labor movement. And so I taught a labor history course on the exclusion of Black labor from the institutionalized labor movement. And what was very interesting to me in teaching that course, and my students agreed with me in reading the material, with me is that most of the stories about interracial solidarity in the labor movement center on white activists, right? So much of the story is about progressive communist activists operating both within the party and within the unions that they infiltrated to realize a vision of interracial solidarity. And then, of course, there's a number of books about the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which broke from the American Federation of Labor in trying to organize workers industrially. And so that's what most of the stories are really about. And what I wanted to find out was, okay, well, surely Black people stood to benefit from interracial solidarity. Who were these Black folks who were kind of the main advocates within the labor movement? What kind of organizations did they build and what did they achieve? And that's what drove me to write this book.
So you're a former labor organizer and former elected labor leader. How so, and how does this experience inform your book?
Yes, well, I was an organizer and strategic researcher for a number of unions, beginning with Local 76, the Connecticut School Bus Drivers Alliance, which was an SEIU project. I then organized with the United Farm Workers, both in corporate campaign on the East Coast and then Salinas and Watsonville in California, and organized with the District 1199 SEIU, which was the same union that Jane McAlevey organized for. And then finally, I would say that I did the last several years of my organizing with the American Federation of Teachers, organizing in higher ed and among paraprofessionals. I was an elected leader. I was local union president of Local 3550, the graduate employees organization at the University of Michigan, which represented at that time 1,700 graduate student instructors. So that's the quick rundown of my experience in the labor movement, and I think that experience shaped the way that I approached this book, in the sense that whenever I was organizing, I was typically organizing in racially diverse settings, and frequently I had to assemble folks from different constituency groups. 1199 organizers, we'll call them social cliques, that were necessarily multiracial, right? The idea in 1199 was that if you want to drive the car, you need the keys, and the keys were the leaders. You needed the cadres who were going to be able to lead a group of workers through struggle. And so I guess I would say that that experience shaped my writing of the book, because most of my experiences in organizing workers were really about building multiracial blocks. And so I was doing it without knowing what the history was behind it and who the prime movers of that kind of set of politics were in the organizing world.
Mm-hmm. So you suggest that Black people have been in the vanguard of the labor movement, Black workers more pointedly. How so? And does that have any relationship to the roots of Black people on this continent? That is to say, being historically the unpaid sector of the working class, i.e. enslaved workers, which in turn compels class struggle.
Yes. So the let's begin with the Black vanguard. Going back to what I said earlier, so much of what we read about the kind of main advocates, right, the leading lights of this interracial project within the labor movement center on white folks. And what I find in the archival data is actually, you know, white labor leaders, white-led trade unions were actually quite uneven and many times hostile to the concept of interracial solidarity. And even the even those white folks who were champions of that vision of the labor movement, of a multiracial working class, sometimes caused more trouble than they solved. And so what I find instead is that actually black people, African Americans, and especially earlier on in this story, Caribbean black folks were really the most consistent set of actors arguing on behalf of an integrated membership, a representative leadership, and for programs that wanted to link both economic and racial justice. That's what I mean by the Black Vanguard, that black folks, more than their white allies, were the most consistent advocates of interracial labor solidarity in the organized union movement. And this does have to do with the legacy of slavery. One thing that, you know, there is a problem in labor history, in the sort of practice of professional labor history, where we see the historiography of slavery and of enslaved people as African American history and not labor history, and of course that's problematic for a number of reasons, because of course black labor did constitute a critical dimension of U.S. labor history, if not the decisive dimension. And what I mean by the decisive dimension is that Southern slave owners made money not only by selling cash crops to Northern manufacturers in places like Massachusetts, where I currently reside. They also made money by hiring out the skilled artisans who were enslaved people, who they owned, to shipyards, factories, and docks all across the United States, to the point that black artisans dominated the skilled trades as far north as New York City. Now, why do I mention that? I say that because some of the first white unions emerged in the 18th century in order to specifically exclude black labor and monopolize those jobs from which they had been previously excluded, that white folks had been previously excluded. So in other words, instead of training their anger against the slave owners who used enslaved labor to make even further profit on top of the profit that they made on cash crops, they turned their ire towards black people. And so the result is that some of the first unions are initially anti-black institutions. And so if we go to the period where my book starts, which is in 1917, we are still living with a labor movement in which white working class people view black workers as competitors, as existential competitors, very much as they did when they were trying to get jobs under slavery. And I think that is one of the main reasons why it is such a long struggle to eventually desegregate unions, because the foundation really of the labor movement was to monopolize for white labor what had been monopolized by black labor via slave owners in the South in the antebellum period.
So what role do black women workers play in your story?
Well, I don't think one can tell the story of the struggle to desegregate American unions without understanding the role of black women. Black women were central to every single one of the phases of this story from 1917 to 1968. Grace Campbell was one of the key cadres of the African Blood Brotherhood, for example. Lucille Randolph, who was an entrepreneur and was the spouse of A. Philip Randolph, essentially bankrolled his early organizing efforts and enabled him to work full-time on behalf of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Thelma Dale was the national organizer of the National Negro Congress in the 1930s, and perhaps the kind of high point of the role of Black women in this struggle was in the 1950s, where Vicki Garvin and Viola Brown were key leaders in the National Negro Labor Council. I can go on. I don't necessarily want to just enumerate everybody, but the point is that at every single step of the way, Black women insisted upon not just their leadership, but also upon a kind of intersectional vision of organizing, in which the main activities of each of the independent Black labor organizations that they led really foregrounded the interests and conditions of Black women, of Black domestic workers, of Black women industrial workers, who, for example, were systematically excluded from assembly line work, from front of the house work, and were essentially relegated to the role of matron, which is a glorified word for housekeeper or janitor. So I really don't think that you can tell the story of interracial labor solidarity from 1917 to 1968 without understanding the ways in which Black women moved in those spaces and insisted upon some redress for Black women in the labor movement.
You mentioned the African Blood Brotherhood. What was it?
The African Blood Brotherhood essentially an international Black self-defense organization that had increasingly strong ties to the international communist movement, and eventually combined with the Communist Party in Harlem. They were called the Workers' Party. So that's in kind of very broad strokes is what the African Blood Brotherhood was. It was organized deliberately like Sinn Féin, like a military organization. And as a matter of fact, the Irish Republican Army was very much on the minds of the key leadership of the African Blood Brotherhood and kind of constructing their organization. The most famous sort of instance of this self-defense activity was in the role of the Tulsa Post of the ABB during the 1921 Tulsa race riots. Now it's quite well known that so-called Black Wall Street was destroyed by a white mob in Oklahoma. The people who defended Black people in that moment were members of the African Blood Brotherhood. And it was actually after their well-known defense of the Black community in Tulsa that their membership started to actually skyrocket, and it became a much more of a household word. Prior to that, it had been a kind of underground militant direct action organization.
You highlight the role of Black migrant labor. In this context, talk to us about Ewart Quinier and Ferdinand Smith.
Yes, well, Ewart Quinier and Ferdinand Smith were both important left cadres in both the National Negro Congress and the National Negro Labor Council, NNLC. So these are the two independent Black labor organizations that operate from the 1930s through to the 1950s. Ferdinand Smith is, I mean, both have Caribbean roots. Winier was associated primarily with the Communist Party, Ferdinand Smith with the Socialist Party. Ewart Winier was active in public employees mass mobilization, and was really one of the key founders of the National Negro Labor Council. And Ferdinand Smith was one of the most high-ranking Black elected officials in the entire labor movement. He was a key leader in the National Maritime Union, and both the public employees and the maritime workers were both left militant, direct action, avowedly socialist or communist organizations. So somewhat similarly to the question of Black women and their role in this story, one cannot tell this story without also talking about Black migrants. Cyril Briggs, for example, we were just speaking about the African Blood Brotherhood, was the leader of the African Blood Brotherhood, and he grew up on the island of Nevis. If we're speaking about African American migration, we can also speak about the migration story there, because some people would insist that A. Philip Randolph is an expat of the American South. He is actually born in Florida, and one of the first things he did when he arrived in Harlem was to actually establish a labor bureau to settle African American migrants from the American South in New York City. So the role of Black migrant labor is all over the place. I mean, it's just intertwined with every single story in this book.
I should mention parenthetically that Cyril Briggs, who you mentioned, who has Caribbean roots, wound up in Los Angeles, where he played a pivotal and instrumental role in many important struggles of the 1960s in particular. But having said that, what about HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee? Mm-hmm. What was it, and what role does it play, particularly in terms of harming Black labor activism?
Yes, well, HUAC was the sort of hammer of the Congress in the Red Scare of the 1950s, and what is interesting about HUAC is that even though the effort on the part of the state to infiltrate these Black labor organizations was ongoing and preceded HUAC in the 1950s. What is so interesting is that even though HUAC is very well known and justly hated by the left, they were actually defanged by the National Negro Labor Council in the 1950s. There was a very public hearing in which HUAC brought some of the key leaders of the NNLC before them, the leaders of the NNLC, especially Coleman Young, made them look like fools, essentially, and really kind of revealing this for the incoherent and opportunistic witch hunt that it was. And so by the accounts that I have read, both the primary and secondary materials, HUAC, while it makes a valiant attempt to demonize the NNLC, fails to do so, and in fact goes back to Washington with their tail between their legs. And some have argued that in fact that public embarrassment was the beginning of the end of HUAC. I don't know if that answers, if that's where you were going with that, but that's what comes to mind for me in terms of the telling of this book.
Finally, Professor De Leon, author of the book Freedom Train, Black Politics and the Story of Interracial Solidarity, Interracial Labor Solidarity, excuse me. What's next on your agenda?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is more clearly draw out some of the implications from this story for fighting fascism in our own time. One thing that is striking about so many of the primary materials, the speeches, the correspondence of these of these folks, is that they saw fascism as the primary enemy, meaning that they viewed the fight against fascism as a two-fronted war. That everybody had to be united to defeat Nazi Germany and Japanese imperialism abroad. And we needed to defeat white supremacy as a form of fascism at home. There were some folks in the National Negro Congress who believed that we needed to open up a third front, a cultural front, so that we could fight for hearts and minds through the theater and dance and the visual arts. And this was always in their view. Yes, they were organizing workers into industrial unions in the 1930s, for example. Yes, they were desegregating employers like American Airlines and General Electric and Sears Roebuck. They were doing all of these things, but there was an overarching strategy to all of this. And the overarching strategy was that all of this was in service, not just to organizing black workers into the labor movement, but in defeating fascism. And I believe that that the labor movement and allied social movements need to take a page out of what the independent black labor movement did in the middle of the 20th century in order to fight fascism in our own time. And so what I am thinking about now in earnest is a book or some kind of publication that I'm thinking of as the United Front or the Broad Front, just to kind of serve as some kind of reference point for folks who are doing anti-fascist organizing today.
Well, Cedric De Leon, author of the book Freedom Train, thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Thank you, Dr. Horn.
And up next is our prison radio commentaries.
Dear friends, forgive me if I don't mention everybody's name, because guess what? I'm 71, y'all. I can't remember everything. But I know Martha is there. Also, Marcus, old friend. All of you. Jules, right? All of you there. I thank you all for supporting the noble efforts of Abolitionist Law Center and the work they do to try to bring freedom to those in cages. What you're doing with raising money for ALC is heroic and tremendous. ALC has been a breath of fresh air, you know, in a state choking on smog. And I should say, in darkness and rain, at least in this part of the state. What you're doing is heroic and noble and right, and it should be supported. And I appreciate all of you for being there, and also for what you do for keeping ALC, their generous heart beating and working and trying to transform the Leviathan we call mass incarceration. Thank you for what you're doing. I appreciate you. I salute you. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Hello to all who are listening. My name is Khalil Hammond, and I am a prisoner of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, currently housed in the Intensive Management Unit at SCI Phoenix. For the past 12 years, I've been kept in solitary under an indefinite status known as the Restricted Release List, which is said to be for the worst of the worst. However, I haven't done anything that would warrant me being labeled as one of the worst prisoners in the state's penal system. In truth, the DOC's hierarchy holds disdain for me because I continue to challenge abuses of power against me and others as unacceptable. This has resulted in me being physically attacked by staff on multiple occasions while in handcuffs and unable to defend myself, destruction of my personal property, and an ever-evolving cycle of oppressive tactics meant to break me. In March of 2024, I became the lead plaintiff in PA's largest class action lawsuit filed by the Abolitionist Law Center, which addresses the issue of prolongation in solitary confinement and how DOC officials weaponize such against its prisoners, especially those suffering mental illness, despite knowing the potential for harmful adverse effects. Since the filing of our suit meant to effectuate change, SCI Phoenix officials have shown me just how much change is unwanted. By manipulating others to show hostility toward me and even falsifying a negative report against me. Sadly, I expected this type of response by DOC personnel, but still, I have no fear, nor will I be deterred. Change is coming whether they want it or not. But while our fight for humane conditions continues in the court, I am in need of supporters who will contact the prison, notifying these corrupt actors that the retaliatory tactics against me must stop immediately. It is our societal support that deters institutional corruption. I am Khalil Hammond, MA number, KC9993.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
This is Sister Flora, and you are listening to Freedom Now at KPFK 90.7 FM in occupied Mexico, including Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Today's program, as well as 10 prior editions, can be reheard at kpfk.org/audio archive, and scroll down to Freedom Now. From 12 to 1 p.m., following Freedom Now, is our sister Asunta, with Spotlight Africa addressing issues facing Mother Africa. For a truly alternative international perspective on world affairs, check out RTTV Russia, CCTV China, and online at Presna, Latina Cuba, Telesur, Venezuela. News 24, South Africa, and Press TV, Iran. We will now continue with historian Professor Dr. Gerald Horn.
For KPFK Radio Los Angeles, this is Gerald Horn, and with me on the line is John Jeter, two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and author of the book Class War in America: How the Elites Divide the Nation by Asking, Are You a Worker or Are You White? Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK Los Angeles, John Jeter.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for joining us. So why write this book, and what do you mean by class war?
Well, this book sort of revealed itself to me sort of, if I may quote the Hemingway book, The Sun Always Rises, gradually and then suddenly. My father was an auto worker in Indianapolis, Black, obviously. And so I was raised in this class milieu, this working class milieu. And so a lot of the stories that I tell in the book are actually sort of my coming to understand the milieu in which I was raised. And I think that really came to a head with the election of Barack Obama, who I, for reasons that have nothing to do with intelligence and everything to do with intuition, I intuited that he was sort of the capstone of this class war in which the employers, the bosses, the investment class has successfully pitted workers against one another along racial lines. I sensed that Barack Obama was really kind of this almost crowning achievement, and that it was going to be downhill from there. So the book started sort of forming in my head really with the election of Barack Obama, actually, I think election night, and a series of events that began to just sort of unfold. and me kind of consciously looking to connect the dots, make sense of what was happening to the country, a Black president, but still a nation that I think I can accurately call in the broadest form an apartheid state. And what utilitarian purpose does that serve? Why do we have an apartheid state? Why do we have a nation in which white workers, many of them, most of them, I think we can safely say, blame Black workers for everything that has befallen the country, as opposed to their bosses, the investment class, the stock class? And so I think over a period of really 10 years, this book sort of just kind of unfolded in my mind, one revelation after another. And I think I would say the one kind of big revelation was probably, and this is a name that I think you will recognize, was probably the scholarship of Phil Foner, who is, people will recognize the name Foner, that is Eric Foner, the historian at, I think, Columbia, maybe emeritus at this point, but his uncle, who was a Marxist and who did a lot of work on the Black worker and the issues facing the Black worker dating back to at least the end of the Civil War. And finding his work really was a revelation in my understanding that this is a class war, but it is fought along racial lines here in the United States.
Speaking of class war, what role do strikes play in your book?
Yeah, great question. The strikes throughout the book, particularly beginning with the Knights of Labor and ending almost abruptly with the last general strike in the country, 1946 in Alameda County, California, Oakland being the center of that. The strikes really are a kind of call to arms for workers of all races. I talk about the Haymarket strike, for instance. Workers of all races, beginning really in earnest with the Knights of Labor, initially workers being able to come together, workers of all races, Black and white, coming together to demand what they felt was rightfully theirs. And so you'll see early in the book with the Knights of Labor, you see these strikes like Haymarket, which were Black and white workers. They might've had segregated unions, but they still worked together. And there's one strike in particular, I think it really tells the tale, 1894 on the New Orleans waterfront, dock worker strike evolved into a general strike. Many of the European immigrants were newer immigrants, German, Italians, and they hadn't thought of themselves, hadn't learned to think of themselves as white. And so what you saw was that the employers would demand of the white workers, hey, we'll deal with you, we'll negotiate with you, we can work this out, but we won't deal with those N-words. And the white employees who had not started to think of themselves as white said, what do you mean you're not going to deal with them? They're workers just like we are, right? And they essentially won the strike because there was this racial solidarity between European workers who hadn't thought of themselves as white at this point and Black workers striking for the same, working for the same ends. And that really helped that ethos, particularly in New Orleans, but I think even across the country, including the Deep South, that ethos kind of held more or less until about 1900. The Wilmington massacre in 1898 was really the beginning of the end, the beginning of the Jim Crow period, which really sought to fracture these interracial coalitions, which were, in effect, they were what kryptonite was to Superman. They were to the elites and the oligarchical class, right? They didn't have an answer for interracial solidarity. That really kind of ended abruptly, that those interracial coalitions, which were expressed as labor strikes, labor stoppages, it really stopped abruptly with the general strike in Oakland in 1946, I think early December of 1946. Shortly thereafter, Congress passed Taft-Hartley, which basically criminalized the general strike, which is a weapon, again, all across the world. The general strike remains a key weapon for workers to redistribute wealth from the employers to the employees. It was strategic. The general strike was just such a weapon, in part because it brought Blacks and whites together. And this is something, I think I mentioned this in the book, and part of that, bringing that together, and we saw this even with the Occupy movement, for instance, is that during these general strikes, Black people have a tendency to start singing, right? And things change in America when Black people start singing in the presence of white people. And so part of the Taft-Hartley Law, part of this outlawing of strikes, was just trying to drive a wedge through these interracial coalitions and to basically stop Black people from singing out in public, because it really does move the needle for the working class when Black people are able to express themselves freely and openly in a democratic society.
So you critique the book by Isabel Wilkerson, Cass, which I recall being turned into a movie, mm-hmm. and the book by Matthew Desmond on poverty. Why?
You will often hear, particularly now with the new left, I guess we could call it, they talk a lot about how identity politics and DEI and how all these racial and tribal issues confound the real issue, which is class. My point is that you can't separate the two. They are intertwined here. Race is used to separate the many so that the few can defeat us. Isabel Wilkerson's book, and I said this in the book, as a young journalist in the early 90s, reading Isabel Wilkerson's stuff when she was the Chicago bureau chief at the New York Times, was a revelation. She is such a beautiful writer. She was not one of my heroes. She was my hero in the early 90s. But this book, I think, Cast, does a disservice to Americans who want to understand our situation. It does so because it doesn't really address the class issue. It reduces racism to this sort of antediluvian fissure, right? That we just have to sort of deal with, like the way that the Indians, as in Southeast Asians, deal with it. And I think that really does a disservice, because if you can't sort of grasp this thing at the root and understand, yes, there is this sort of ancient tribal rifts that we have to deal with. But, you know, as Theodore Allen wrote in his book, The Invention of the White Race, there were no whites when Europeans first arrived in 1619, there were no whites there, and there wouldn't be for another 70 years. Racism was created to essentially create something I will call, I don't mean to be impolite, but it was a scab. Whites were scabs. They were created as scabs to drive a wedge through organized labor, both officially and unofficially organized labor movements, right? The other book, Matthew Desmond's book, I think, it's just the opposite problem. It doesn't address the racial issue, the use of race to divide us, right? That race, just like class, is something meant so that the few can fight the many, right? It is, again, it's their Achilles heel, is when there's interracial solidarity. And it has been since almost the formation of this country, when whites see blacks as workers as opposed to, you know, whatever it is they invent in their minds. When they see that, things start to move in this country. So Matthew Desmond's book, I believe, respectfully, doesn't address the critical issue of race in any real fashion. And Isabel Wilkerson's book, I think, fails to address the issue of class. I think you have to talk about both if you want to have any meaningful understanding of what confronts the United States in 2025.
So who was George Jackson, and what role does he play in your book?
George Jackson is sort of and maybe there are many, but he's sort of the conscience of my book in a lot of ways. A lot of his analysis, he was I would call him a political prisoner. He was jailed as a very young man. I can't remember the exact age. And he was jailed for a robbery, which he probably didn't commit. He may have been with someone who committed a robbery, and he was jailed for something ridiculous, like 5 years to life, right? This indeterminate sentence for something that was, and this was, I believe, his first offense, his first criminal offense. He was jailed. He became part of this group called the Soledad Brothers, prison reformers in California. He wrote a wonderful book, Soledad Brothers, which was about his younger brother, in part about his younger brother, Johnson Jackson, who was a teenager who tried to free George Jackson, believing he was wrongfully imprisoned, kidnapped a judge and a guard, thinking that kidnapping this judge would keep police from firing. He was mistaken. They fired, killed Johnson Jackson, two other people. Many people might remember or at least know of. Angela Davis was then arrested for providing the guns to Johnson Jackson. And anyway, George Jackson was later assassinated. A few years later, I think he was assassinated. And the cover story was that he was trying to escape. There had been another black prisoner who had been killed by prison guards, and George Jackson organized, I guess, sort of an uprising. They said he was trying to escape, and they shot and killed him. But he wrote two books which were really foundational for my own thinking. One is A Soledad Brother. The other, and I think it's more important even for my thinking for this book, was Blood in My Eye. And George Jackson, he says, I think I quote him at the beginning of the book, that the biggest barrier the biggest barrier to a working class movement in the United States is white racism. That is the basis, the thesis of my book. White racism is why we can't have nice things, why the working class can't have nice things in the United States. Once we deal with that, we will be on our way. The opposition is just going to fall down, but they have no answer for a unified, interracial working class in the long term. So George Jackson's really one of I should have named him a co-author as well as several others, but yeah, he is. His thinking really kind of informed this book.
Speaking of working class movements, what role do unions play in your text?
Unions are the greatest thing that ever happened to the working class in the United States, and at the same time, the worst thing that ever happened to the working class in the United States. I begin the book, again, you asked me about strikes. The unions, beginning with the Knights of Labor, tenuously brought black and white workers together. Again, Knights of Labor were segregated unions, but they worked in tandem. And once they began to really sort of work across racial lines, people like Ida B. Wells, the great journalist, muckraking journalist, was a huge fan of the Knights of Labor. And they began to defeat in these strikes with these interracial labor movements, union organized labor. They began to challenge and defeat in these strikes. The Jeff Bezos of his day, ran the railroads. I can't remember his name now. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Jay Gould. Yes. Jay Gould. Organized labor, when it brought blacks and whites together to articulate what would later be called a civil rights vision of organized labor, which means that it's not just about how much you paid, how much time you get off, how many vacation days you get, but about unions being advocates for the working class, for the community as a whole. That became the template, very much informed by, you know, African ideas of communalism. That became the template, and that was powerful. That was powerful during the Knights of Labor time, up until during the New Deal, the Scottsboro Boys case, nine black teenagers arrested falsely for raping two white sex workers. The movement started very much by the communists who worked with blacks in the South to basically eventually exonerate these nine black youths. That movement intersected with organized labor in a very robust way. Remember that the nadir of the Great Depression, it intersected with the organized labor. The CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, born in 1935, its raison d'etre was to address the failures of the American Federation of Labor, which after the fall of the Knights of Labor, the American Federation of Labor became the premier organized labor umbrella group in the country, and they were explicit in their racism. They wanted white workers, not black workers. The Congress of Industrial Organizations formed with the idea they would reverse that. They would actually recruit aggressively blacks into their unions. The CIO became the template for labor organizing during the New Deal. The UAW, United Auto Workers, my father was a member of the UAW, aggressively recruited blacks, and not just recruited blacks, but at least initially, they were advocates for the black community. They talked about, they openly talked about racism and housing, law enforcement, right? Police violence. They were advocates for the black community. And then once World War II was over, they kind of fell back. And it really, a lot of it is attributable to one man, Walter Reuther, who is, many people might recall, or at least understand, was the only white man on the stage at Martin Luther King's March on Washington in 1963. Widely, I think, thought of as a race man, maybe we could say, a man who was an outspoken advocate for African-Americans, but in reality, he was a huge barrier for black workers. He negotiated with the UA, with the big three automakers in probably in the late 50s. He negotiated a secret codicil by which black workers could not be promoted to supervisory positions or skilled trades positions. My father, when he went to go work at Indianapolis Chrysler in 1965, there were no black skilled tradesmen. He became the first black skilled tradesman in Chrysler. That was actually something negotiated by Walter Reuther as head of the UAW with the big three automakers. And the reason was he saw his power base within the UAW as being whites, particularly whites who were from, like he was, West Virginia, Appalachia, places like that, who had moved to Detroit and other places north to work. And he didn't have the vision of an actual, he could talk the talk, but he couldn't walk the walk in terms of having a vision for an interracial organized labor movement. And organized labor basically, I think, is really the, I think journalism would be another, if I could speak of my vocation. But organized labor, I think, really is the hero and the villain in my book. It when it worked well, reasonably well, it really lifted up the entire working class. But the betrayal of black workers is really a theme that leads us to where we are today. Although I should say this, and I think this happened maybe right when I published my book, I do see signs of a renewal of what the CIO did in the 30s and 40s and maybe early 50s, which is that I see with the Starbucks workers, with the Amazon workers in Staten Island, at least, you see with the UAW, even this work at on college campuses in California in the anti genocide movement, you do see the possibility. I don't think we can say it's there yet, but we do see the possibility of a reformation of that kind of organized labor that crosses racial boundaries. I think it's possible we might see that kind of reconciliation and progress that we saw in the 30s and 40s. I hope this time, though, that if it does happen, that African Americans understand we need to prepare for a moment when the white working class will betray us once again, because not necessarily because to be cynical, but because that has been the pattern. And I just think we need to prepare for that. So anyway, that's a very long-winded answer to your question, I hope.
Speaking of where we are today, what role does one Donald J. Trump play in your book?
None, really. But I know that probably sounds surprising. I mean, I talk about Trump as sort of this, you know, all of our presidents, and I don't really say this judgmentally, I'm being very serious here, they're really carnival barkers. Our presidents are carnival barkers. And I think we can make the case that all of them, to a certain extent, because they do work for the employers, for the industrialists, for the financiers, right? That all of them, they seek to drive a wedge between the working class, usually along racial lines. I think FDR might be the one exception in the last century. And even he had some issues with race, as we saw with the way that the New Deal developed. But they all are basically carnival barkers, even Obama, right? You think about Obama scolding black men for, you know, feeding their kids Popeye's chicken. And Obama had an obsession with Popeye's chicken. He was always talking about what we were doing with Popeye's chicken, throwing the wrappers on the street corners, you know, not we shouldn't litter by throwing the Popeye's chicken wrappers on the street corners. So Ronald Reagan, obviously, Bill Clinton, I think, is one who I don't think we really underestimate just the damage he did, because he had an opportunity in the early 90s after the Democrats had been out of the White House for 12 years. He had an opportunity to remake the Democratic Party in the image of Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, which had enormous promise, right? But instead, he chose to out-racist the GOP. And that's the Democratic Party we see today. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, who can't even say the word reparations, right? She wonders why she lost. So Donald Trump, you know, he's louder, right? I do believe he is going to put the final nail in the coffin of the American empire. The things that he's doing are accelerating America's decline. You know, tariffs might not be a bad idea if you're actually going to invest in certain industries, domestic industries, to make these products, create jobs. Tariffs, if you don't actually invest in the industries, make absolutely no sense. They're just going to raise inflation. So Donald Trump is this sort of, I guess, maybe the best or the worst, maybe, Carnival Barker of all the presidents. He's not taking us in any different direction. He doesn't have an answer to what ails us. I do think he's an inflection point, but that's only because of everyone who's come before him, certainly for the last 40 years, beginning with Ronald Reagan. He's become, he marks the inflection point, the point at which I think we are going to really see a dramatic and sudden decline in the American empire, which has been happening, again, for the last 40, 45 years. But Donald Trump, I think, you know, he is the last president of this empire in decline that refuses to respond to the needs of its working class.
Finally, John Jeter, author of the book Class War in America, what's next on your agenda?
A great question. I don't know. I've started my own publishing company, Drum, and we're trying to really start to publish these kinds of books, you know, books sort of, I don't know if there's any parallel to what you do, Dr. Horn, but books such as those that you publish, books that really sort of talk about the reality of our situation. So many of these books that are being published today don't really talk about things like class war, don't really talk about, you know, the real roots of slavery in the United States as you do. And so I'm hoping that I can publish. I am working right now on a book by a young Black doctor in South Florida who is writing about the history of racism in medicine and how it affects. We do need a single payer healthcare system. He talks about that in depth, but we also need to address the racism in medicine. Babies who die, infants who die, at three times the rate of white babies, Black babies die at three times the rate of white babies before their first birthday. That's not because of single payer healthcare. That's because of racism. That is because of racism. So this is what I'm hoping to do, is to write more, to publish more, and to speak out more. I hope to sort of give people an understanding of what really ails us, because the media just has really dropped the ball. It's never been good, but I think, you know, 30 years ago, at least we sometimes could get the answer, and it wasn't as harmful. Now the media is just awful, and I'm hoping that I can contribute to rectifying that.
Well, John Jeter, author of the book Class War in America, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Thank you, Dr. Horn.
And in closing, we'd like to thank our guest, Cedric De Leon. Thank you, John Jeter. Thank you to our producers, Dr. Gerald Horn, Sister Flora, Brother Brandon, our board op Wendell, and all those who made today's program possible. Please stay tuned for our Sister Assumpta coming up next with Spotlight Africa, addressing issues facing Mother Africa. Signing off for Freedom Now, this is Sister Thage, and as always, we stand ready for revolution.
Join listener-supported KPFK. Call now, 818-985-5735.
Hey, this is Wanda Sykes, and you're listening to KPFK,